What time is it now? 4:30, right? So we might as well begin by saying good afternoon. All right, we're going to try again. Good afternoon. This is much better. There's actually a cultural requirement in my culture. Before you speak to any audience, you have to offer salutation. And if you don't hear back from the audience, that would be their very polite way of saying to you, take a hike. So before I speak, I usually say good afternoon or good evening, whatever is appropriate. And if I don't hear from the audience, sometimes I start leaving the room, you know. So, well, thank you very much. I'd like to express my gratitude to all the departments that conspired to make my visit possible. Thank you very much. So last February, wasn't it? I met Jeff and Masha in Washington, D.C. I don't know how they found me, but they invited me to be the featured author at a major conference that they host every year, which turned out to be one of the most warm conferences that I've been invited to speak in. So we struck a friendship, it seemed. And I told them right there and then that I'd like to visit your home. And so I was delighted that it became possible for me to come and visit. And what a wonderful turnout of students. I know some of you are here by compulsion, are you not? But that's fine. You're not going to regret it. Sometimes professors are not always wrong. Just most of the time. All right. How do I start? I usually actually start by telling a story or two about me, right? And I do this because I think that stories are graced to a pedagogical enterprise, what happens in the classroom. So I tell students, when you find your voice in the classroom, then you become a full citizen of that community. A community for me is a space where all of us achieve a voice. And so when I run a class, I have every student introduce him or herself with a story, right? And so when you do, you become a full citizen of that community. So I'm going to start by becoming a full citizen of this community by telling you a story. Is that okay with you all? Uh-huh, good. All right. So I was thinking of what stories would be appropriate, and I'm going to tell you two. I'm going to tell you a story of how I became a writer of fiction, but I'm also going to tell you a story about, actually, let's vote, because, you know, it's good to have a democracy, right? So I could either tell you a story of my arrest for bank robbery. That's one possibility. I could tell you about my ride on the back of a crocodile, right? I could tell you about, what other possibility should I leave you with? I could tell you about a story that I call Going Dutch, my Going Dutch story. Which one would you rather hear? So, arrest for bank robbery, a ride on the back of a crocodile, and Going Dutch. By voice, yes. Number two. Crocodile. Wonderful.
Bank robbery.
Somebody wants to know both of them. Why not? Yeah, somebody wants to know, you know, because when I show up, people say to me, you look independently wealthy. So how did you make your money, right? And I say to them, yeah. So before I came to this country, which was my very first visit to this country, in fact, to Europe. I've been to a few African countries, but never outside of the continent. And so it was a big rite of passage for me. And so my parents and uncles and aunts arranged an event where, in a lot of ways, I was going to receive their blessings and receive instructions on how to thrive and travel peacefully around the world. And so all kinds of advice were coming to me. And finally, an uncle of mine said to me, okay, when you get to America, make sure that you don't make eye contact with Americans. And they said, because every American carries a gun, and if you look them in the face, they will think you are being provocative, and they will shoot you. Well, this uncle had never been to America. But finally, I figured out that, you know, much later, that what had happened was that in those days, from time to time, a movie will be shown, usually in a football field. And when I say football, it's important to underscore that I mean football, right? Good, real football. Not the tough handball that Americans call football. Take no offense, Americans. It's good to hear the truth sometimes. So from time to time, there'll be these movies shown. They were usually Westerns. And they were usually very old affairs, you know, with black and white. The pictures were grainy. There was usually a discrepancy, a gap between the movement of the lips and the sound of the voice. And so we didn't understand what they were saying, these actors. But at some very pivotal moment in the movie, usually in a bar, the actors, a group of actors, will sort of huddle in the center and stare each other down, and that became the signal that they were going to pull guns from both sides of the hip and start shooting. And so the audience would go into a frenzy, you know, especially that moment when they were shooting down bottles, see? Yeah? And so my uncle formed the impression, because they met in the middle and they stared each other down, my uncle said, wow, maybe in America, the worst capital offense you could commit against another person was to look them in the eye. So he said to me, see, I watch those movies. So he said to me, make sure you don't look Americans in the face. So I said I wasn't going to. So I arrived here and I spent my first 9 days avoiding eye contact. So when I was talking to Americans, I'll look to the ground, I'll look up, I'll look sort of vacantly into space, but I never made eye contact. So on day 10, December 20, 1988, I was waiting at the bus stop in Amherst, Massachusetts to go see a Nigerian professor at UMass. He and I had a meeting, and a police officer was driving past in his cruiser, and he and I made eye contact. So I missed a heartbeat. I said, whoa, look this guy in the face. He's going to shoot me. So I quickly made a dramatic gesture of looking away to say to him, look, I didn't mean to insult you by making eye contact. But I was sort of watching the man with the side of my eye. So I saw him turn into a side street and I heaved a sigh of relief because I'd lost him. Well, a minute or so later, I got a tap on the shoulder and I looked, and here was this tall police officer in front of me. And so he said to me, sir, do you mind coming to the back of the bus stop? Well, a moment of cultural disorientation. In Nigeria, where I come from originally, nobody in uniform says, sir, to an idle civilian. Okay? And nobody uses the language, the phrase, do you mind? They pull or push you where they want you to be. So for a moment, I thought I had a choice in the matter. that I could say to this guy, I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry, I can't meet you right now. But on second thought, I said, this man is genial, so let me meet him immediately. So I said, I don't mind. So I came to the back of the bus stop, and he folded his hands, and he says to me, sir, you know what this is about, right? I said, no. He said, are you sure you don't know what this is about? I said, no. Of course, I knew what it was about. I had made eye contact with him. But I wasn't going to admit it, because if I admitted it, then I opened myself up to being killed instantly. So I adopted a policy of interminable, perpetual denial. So I said, no, I don't know what it's about. Well, the officer said to me, there's been a bank robbery and you fit the description. I said, whoa. So I began to explain to him that I just arrived in America 10 days ago. I'd not been inside a bank. And I felt that if I wanted to rob a bank, I'll need some more preparation, right? I'll need to know where to get the guns and, you know, the masks and how to move in and move out and get a vehicle. I didn't have a car and so on. And of course, I wasn't joking. It's much later that I insert that aspect. But I just denied. I said, no, I've not been inside a bank. As I was saying this, I did not want to compound my crime by making eye contact with the officer. So I was looking at his chest through all of this. So much later, of course, I realized that I was looking suspicious because I wasn't making eye contact, right? But I didn't want to compound my crime. So finally, the officer said to me, do you have identification? I said, no. He said, why not? I said, well, I just arrived and my only form of ID was my passport. And I said, I didn't think it made sense to carry it on me wherever I went because I might lose it. So he said to me, do you mind if I frisk you? Well, frisk was not part of my vocabulary at the time, but I somehow could fathom that whatever frisk meant, I had no choice in the matter. So I said, I don't mind. He could have meant, do you mind if I kill you? So he asked me to throw my hands up, which I did, and he began to pat me down, convinced that I had no weapons of mass or single destruction. He said, do you mind if I take you to your apartment? I'd like to see your passport. Again, I said, I didn't mind. Now, I come from a country where the police, like the police here, can be corrupt. And I've been known to engage in the framing up of innocence. And indeed, has been known to engage in extrajudicial execution. So as the man said, I want to take you in my vehicle to go see your passport. What was racing through my mind is this guy could take me to some isolated place and just kill me. So began to consider my options. Should I just run for it? But I considered a bullet hitting me from behind. Could I start shrieking? Because it was a very densely packed bus stop and everybody was now turned at the, you know, through the plexiglass and was looking at me. So should I start pleading, asking for people to come to my rescue? Or should I be compliant and hope on the mercy, goodness and generosity of this officer? So I took that option. So I entered the vehicle. Well, this officer drove me to my house where Chinua Achebe's two younger children, Chidi and Wanda, were spending their Christmas vacation with me. So I walked in and spoke to them in Igbo, which is my Nigerian language. I said, I've been arrested for bank robbery. Yeah. But I went to my room and got my passport and I showed it to the officer. And he began to check, you know, punch on some little machine he had in his hands. And after a while, you know, this ritual sufficed to tell him that I wasn't the person they were looking for. So he handed me my passport and said, thanks for being a gentleman, as if I had an option. So as he was about to leave, it struck me that so many people had seen this officer pick me up from the bus stop. And so I said, wow, people are going to see me in town and point to me and say, we don't quite have the details, but this guy is some kind of criminal. We saw the police pick him up. So I wanted to instigate a counter-narrative. So I said to the officer, do you mind dropping me back, using this phrase, dropping me back at the bus stop? So that some people will say, as people will point to me and say, this guy is a criminal, a police officer picked him up. Other people will say, we saw a police officer drop him off at the bus stop, right? So one narrative canceling out the other, hopefully. So the officer said he didn't mind. So he picked me up in his vehicle and dropped me at the bus stop. Of course, I arrived at the office of the Nigerian professor that I had a meeting with and he wasn't there. But his office was open, so I waited. About an hour later, he walked in and was quite surprised when he saw me. So he said, when did you get here? I said, I've been here for more than an hour. What happened was that I had forgotten to tell Achebe's children that I'd been cleared. So they called him as soon as I left with the officer back in his vehicle and said, okay, he's been picked up for bank robbery. So he got in his car and ran to the police station in Amherst and said, there's this guy called OK. They said, we don't have any OK on our records. So finally, he went to South Hali, a neighboring town, and went to yet another town asking at the police stations and said, no, we don't have a record of this guy. He came back to Amherst police and said, did he turn up? They said no. And they called Achebes and said, are you sure he was with Amherst police? They said, yeah, we clearly saw that on the police cruiser. And so he said to the police, I'm going to go call an attorney. So he showed up in his office and I've been waiting and waiting for him. So in case you wonder then how I became independently wealthy, I hit the ground and robbed the bank quickly. And by the way, because we're in a college, so a few years ago I was teaching at this college, and as I said, I start my classes by telling a story. So I told a different story, the crocodile story, right? And then I said to the students, sometime in the course of the semester, I'm going to tell you about my arrest for bank robbery. And of course, they wanted to hear the story immediately. I said, no, if you are nice, sometime in the semester, I'll tell you. So the very next class I walked in, and I was about to start the class, and this student raised her hand and said, what is it about your arrest for bank robbery? So I said, it's not a story I'm going to tell today. And she said, well, I called my mom and told her that one of my professors was arrested for bank robbery and she's not cool with it. So my mom said, I must hear the story, I should go to the chair of the department. So I weighed my options. I had told the chair of the department the story. So I said, should I have him spoil my story or should I tell? And I was in a generous mood, so I told. So how did I come to writing fiction? I was invited to this country by Chinua Achebe, a great author of Things Fall Apart, who died 2 years ago. There are seats, please. Would you please come in? Yeah? And so I left Nigeria and relocated to America to undertake that project. 2.5 years later, the magazine had to fold because it was just taking guzzling money and wasn't making enough money because we didn't have advertising at all. And so after the magazine ceased publication, I was in predicament. I had left a thriving job as an editor of a weekly magazine in Nigeria to come take up the editorship, the founding editorship of African Commentary, this magazine that Chinua Achebe founded. So what was I to do? One option was, come on in if you don't mind, yeah? Good. One option was to go back to Nigeria. Then one day, I ran into John Edgar Wideman. Who knows of John Edgar Wideman in the room? Good. He's a fascinating writer, one of my favorite American writers. So I ran into John Edgar Wideman, and he'd been one of the columnists for the magazine. So he said to me, so what are you going to do now that the magazine has ceased production? And I said, I hadn't figured it out. And he said to me, you're writing a novel, right? I wasn't writing a novel. But the way he asked a question, I felt that the imperative was to say yes. So I said yes. I felt that if I had said no to John Edgar Wideman, that he would never talk to me the rest of his life, that he would see me as subhuman. So I said yes. So he said to me, why don't you get me 15 to 20 pages of what you're working on next week, and let me see if I could get you a fellowship to read, do your MFA at UMass, where he was a professor then. He just retired last year, actually, from Brown. So he and I were colleagues at Brown, eventually. So I got home and began to write furiously without knowing if what I was writing made sense, if it resembled fiction at all. But all I knew and all I counted on was that I had read a lot of novels in my time. Well, the following week, I took what I had produced, all 23 pages of it, to John Edgar Wideman. And 2 days later, he called me and gave me a rather flattering first review of my work. And he said, okay, I really love your writing, and that it reminded him of the work of Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. Now, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o is one of, again, my favorite writers in the world. So to be likened, even in those unfleshed days of being a writer, to Ngugi's work was really extraordinary. And so that's how I started. And so the moral of the story is, tell lies. But live up to the lies that you tell. So You're all working on novels, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Send me a copy of it, like, in a year, all right? Well, so thank you very much for listening to my story. So this becomes, again, my way of introducing myself. I am known as an anti-reader. So I tell stories and then I read a very small slice of fiction because I've been to readings and when a writer opens a book and inflicts 20 pages of it on you, even the best writing becomes that very process of being an adult, being read to. When I was a child, I loved it when my parents read to me. But I don't like being read to, right? As an adult, I prefer to have that book and read it myself. So I don't do unto audiences what I don't like other writers to do unto me. So that's why I tell stories, but I'm gonna read. In fact, we're gonna read from two books, if you don't mind. So my first novel, which is Arrows of Rain, was published by Heinemann in his African Writers series. And has just been republished by my American publishers this January, January 6th. I guess Foreign God, Inc., my second novel, was doing very well. And as publishers do, they say to you, hey, we want more from you, right? And the genesis of Foreign God, actually, the germination, the idea, the seed that became Foreign God, had its genesis in Heinemann wanting something quickly. So after Arrows of Rain came out, it became Heinemann's best-selling novel in about 10 years. And so they called me and said, we want you to give us another book quickly. And I said, I don't write quickly. I quibble with sentences. I write a sentence and I fall in love with it. Then I wake up in the morning and I see this sentence lying next to me. And I say, ooh, what do we have here? Right? But if you're a writer, rather than, you know, with a human lying next to you, if you're a writer, you can do something about it. You can reshape it and make it beautiful. Then you sleep over it and you wake up and say, not there yet. You know, so I quibble and I quarrel and I fight with my sentences and I, you know, so it takes a lot for me to be happy with one sentence, much less a paragraph, much less a chapter. So I told Heinemann I couldn't guarantee to write quickly, but I could write what I threatened to write short stories. It's a threat I've never been able to carry out in my life, but I gave that threat. I said, I could give you 8 to 10 short stories. I said, write it. So Foreign God, Inc. actually started his career as a short story. And I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but by the time I was done, it was at 1,200 plus pages. And I spent close to 3 years just cutting it to what you have here. So, all right. So let's read after pausing to drink water provided by our sponsors. So we're going to start by reading from Arrows of Rain. And Arrows of Rain actually, again, was inspired by when John Edgar Wideman said to me, you are working on a novel, right? I took on a subject. The only subject that I was fascinated by at that time, a subject of silence and power. Silence and power. I had read Wole Soyinka's prison memoir. Wole Soyinka is a Nigerian who won the Nobel Prize in 1986 for literature. And during the Nigerian Civil War of 1967 to 1970, he'd registered his moral opposition to the injustice that fomented the war. And had traveled in Europe and America trying to lobby European governments and American governments not to sell weaponry to either side because Soyinka was opposed to this war. He felt that the Southeasterners, my part of the country, had been dealt an unjust hand, but he felt that war wasn't the answer. Well, when he returned to Nigeria, the Nigerian government wasn't impressed that he was abroad campaigning against them, getting the weapons to subjugate this region, the Southeastern state, a southeastern region of Nigeria that was wanted to succeed. So the government put Soyinka in detention for 24 months, most of it in solitary confinement. And whilst there, he began to write what became his prison memoirs. And the title was, the title is, The Man Died. The Man Died. And I began to read that book as a high school student. There's a line in it that haunted me, still haunts me. And Soyinka says, the man dies in all who keep silent in the face of tyranny. The man, I would say, the woman also, dies in all who keep silent in the face of tyranny. So that was one. Then I came to this country and I got to read Sophocles' Antigone, where you see a young woman defy the king who has ruled at her brother, who had come in with an invading force against his own city and died in the process, should not be buried. How many of us have read Antigone? Yeah, so you know the story. If you haven't, read it. So important. It speaks so much to our time. And speaks powerfully. So I read it. And in standing up against the king and justifying her action, Antigone makes several arguments. One argument is that she owed a filial duty to her brother to give him proper burial rights. That's one argument. The other argument is actually that she says that the community approves of what she's done, even though they're too scared of the king to speak it or to express their support. And the other one is that she argues that the gods, that what she's done is consistent with what the gods would want her to do. So at every level, at the human level, at the moral level, at the ethical level, at the level of the sacred, she is invoking the rightness of the decision she's made. So I was obsessed, if you like, fascinated by the subject of silence. What makes us silent when speech is imperative? Why do we keep silent in the face of injustice, right? And so it struck me that I wanted to write a novel that would dramatize this subject. And so I have an African, so the very phrase Arrows of Rain is actually a phrase, because Achebe has a novel called Arrow of God. A lot of African scholars think that the title of my novel, Arrows of Rain, is an attempt to sort of rub up to Achebe's book. No, Arrows of Rain is a phrase from one translation of Antigone, so by Sophocles. So there's a grandmother in this novel who tells her grandson, who is a journalist, that a story that must be told never forgives silence. A story that must be told never forgives silence. So the section that I want to read features my protagonist, who is a reporter, a journalist, who has just returned from burying his father, who is his hero, a man he admires, and has returned to his post to find out that he's received an invitation to attend a party by a government minister, who is a minister of social issues, social affairs, and his job is simply to throw parties. See, so he throws parties every day for fellow ministers, you know, and so they have young women who just go to these parties, and the young women beg and in fact die to get into this party. And this man takes a kind of profane pride, you know, that my job is to throw parties. And so he writes to this guy who is a critic of the government, as I am. I write a weekly column which has put me in trouble with an Nigerian government, has got me designated as an enemy of the state in Nigeria. And so I've been arrested 6 times at the airport and detained anything from 2 hours to 10 hours for basically calling the corrupt by their proper name week after week. Okay. So I'm going to read chapter 12. Anybody with Arrows of Rain, a copy of Arrows of Rain? You have it. Let's go to chapter 12, which is page 129. Yeah, when I read, by the way, reading for me becomes a communal, orchestral event. so that you don't hear just my voice. You're going to hear several voices, at least two. Who else has a copy of Arrows of Rain? Anybody else? Okay. I suspect that because it's been taped, right? Would there be a legal question if she reads beside me? She can sign the waiver later, right? Or do you want me to read alone?
It's not up to me.
It's up to me. I'm invoking my veto to say, come to the stage, please. Okay? You don't mind being shown to the world?
No, I probably know most of the people in this room. Possibly.
Lovely, lovely. But you'll be shown to the world, not just, you know, anybody in the
that's
world.
Okay. Yeah, that's yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hopefully.
Okay. A few others with a book. Who else has a book? Come on in, come on in. Come on. Yeah, come.
Yeah, I'm not alone.
Come, come, come. Come. Come, guys, let's have fun. Okay? Yes, good. Lovely. So this is how it goes, right? I'm going to read a paragraph. Then if I motion to you, you read a paragraph. If you are reading, okay, if you are reading, I'm reading, and the spirit moves you, okay? Read into my reading, okay? So, because if you are reading and I feel like it, I just start reading over what you're reading. Don't stop if I join you, okay? So people will have layered voices, okay? All right, Ruben Atta, at the time, the country's Minister for Social Issues, was the most flamboyant member of Prime Minister Askia Ramin's cabinet. He was like one of those men in the world of cigarette advertising, ruggedly handsome, with a well-groomed mustache and sharp eyes. While the other ministers tended to be married, out of shape and dull, Atta was athletic, charismatic, and his own words, an incurable bachelor. He was always quietly smoking a Cuban cigar, which lent him an added aura of sensuousness and power.
In terms of education, Atta stood somewhere in the middle of the cabinet, neither as educated as Dr. Titus Bato and brash Minister for National Planning, or Professor Yagons Yaw, was the former free-breathing Marxist, nor as unlettered as Chief Julius
Jupiter Jelowo,
who held the portfolio of traditional matters.
Atta had a number of dubious certificates from several London-based institutes, Fellow of the Institute of Public Relations, Chartered Member of the Institute of Marketing, Member of the Institute of Secretaries.
4 days after I returned from my father's funeral, I came to work and found a stylish envelope on my desk. I slit it open and read the strange message it contained.
Bear with me any night of your choice. From 8 p.m., Ruben Atta, Honorable Minister
for Social Justice Issues.
It gave the minister's home address. Why he had invited me, a journalist with a record of making trouble for his government, I could not tell. But I was curious, and in any case in need of distraction from my bereavement, I decided to go that very evening. Yeah.
I arrived at the minister's home at 9:15 p.m. The gate was under siege by a crowd of women jostling to be let in. Three heavy-set men stood bearing in the way. These men, I quickly found, were screeners. Now and then, they pointed to one of the women and said,
You go in. The lucky woman then squished through a crush of bodies to gain entrance. Once past the gate, she stopped to spruce up, then strode up the driveway with a gait calculated to mark the unchosen ones.
I waded through the press of bodies,
fished out my invitation card, and handed it to one of the screeners. He examined it closely, turning it over twice. I'm from the Daily Monitor, I said, hoping that information will be helpful to my case. Ah, you're welcome, sir. Please go in. As soon as he uttered those words, I was seized by many hands as the women clamored to be taken with me. It was only with the assistance of the screeners that I was able to extricate myself and pass through the gate. When I reached the house, my heart was pounding. I paused outside the door to collect myself before going in.
The room I entered was large, high-ceilinged, and brightly lit. A smell of food and cigar smoke filled the air. A band was playing blues, but nobody was dancing. People sat in small clusters, one or two men ringed by several women. Most of the men were stout and middle-aged, all the women young and lithe.
A tall man came up to me. I recognized him at once as Ruben Atta and extended his right hand. I shook it and introduced myself. Welcome, my friend. Welcome. I'm glad you could join us. Thank you for inviting me. The pleasure is all mine.
He led me to a corner of the room where several cabinet ministers were seated, attended by a retinue of women. The women sat on the minister's lap or massaged their necks. The minister drank and conversed calmly as if
the women hanging about them were natural extensions of themselves. Professor Yao and Chief Amanka sat together. The lad had sprawled on a large round puff. Atta introduced me. You are the rat who wrote nonsense about me, Amanka shouted, bolting up like a man stung by a bee. Atta put out a restraining hand. Rats don't write, I riposted. Not even nonsense. But Amanka did not hear me for all his raving and ranting. The other ministers murmured and grumbled that they did not want press boys at their parties.
He's here as a friendly force, Atta said, to appease Amanka and reassure the others. I wanted to shout a disclaimer, but my anger was too hot for words.
Yor drew Amanka away. He's a young man, Yor said. He was obviously misled. We must forgive him. I shook. The ministers took up Yor's words like a refrain. He was misled, they echoed, grinning contentedly. I shook with rage, but my tongue stayed cold. Atta held me by my shoulder and gently prodding said, let me introduce you to other guests.
Three European ambassadors covered it with several young women who seemed engaged in the silent struggle to be the ambassador's native sex for the night. The two African diplomats fared rather worse than their European counterparts in the attention of women. Then there were a number of officers from the Army, Air Force and Navy, some European and American businessmen, several senators, and a sundry assortment of lawyers, doctors, architects and contractors.
Each guest acknowledged me with a smile, a nod, or a handshake. Finally, Atta took me to the corner of the room where a sturdy man with carefully crimped hair sat almost isolated from the rest of the party. His female companion leant against him, both of them enveloped in the halo of smoke the man blew from his cigar. Mr. Stramulos, Atta said in introduction. He then mentioned my name and affiliation. Without lifting his eyes, Stramulos nodded ever so slightly. His companion glanced up, fleetingly met my gaze, then laid her head back on Stramulos' chest. My heart fluttered with excitement.
Peter Stramulos was a shadowy figure in Madian public affairs.
A man about whom people knew little. Nobody disputed that he was a trusted confidant of Prime Minister Amin. Some claimed that he was the launderer of the Prime Minister's loot. He was known to be stupendously rich. A man who spent a fortune on rare sports cards, overseas villas, jewelry, and horses, though the sources of his money were unknown. An impressive crowd, I said to Atta at the end of my round of introductions. Movers and shakers, yes, he said. Every night do you have this kind of crowd? Tonight is nothing. You should come when His Excellency is in attendance. The Prime Minister? Yes, he's here all the time. In fact, he would have been here tonight, but for some urgent national matter that came up. To lead a nation is no joke. Very true. And His Excellency doesn't joke with his work, I'm sure. But when he plays hard too.
Fair enough. What do you wish to drink? Orange juice, please.
What? Come on, be a man. I need to calm down. I was mobbed at your gate.
Oh, those girls. Every girl in town wants to gate crash my party. It was frightening. Believe me, it was nothing. Wait until midnight.
You mean it gets crazier? That's the boss. A girl even died. No. Yes, this is what? August, isn't it? 5 months ago, one lady died outside my gate. The minister's face came alive with pride. Competition to get into our task party. This is the biggest party in town.
But to die for a party, that's going a bit too far.
The cabinet came to the same conclusion. We extensively debated the incident and decided that such a tragedy must not recur. That's why we took the prudent step of forming the power platoon. A military unit?
Oh no, he said, laughing. There are a number of girls, 30 in all, who were permanent guests at my party. We named them the Power Platoon.
Makes sense. You are in power, and they are your foot soldiers, sort of, I suggested. Atta laughed and said, now how about a swig of cognac? It's a highly recommended nerve calmer. I'm game. He pressed a bell. A man wearing black trousers, a white shirt, a bow tie, and black jacket appeared. Get a Hennessy for our honored guest, VSOP. Will do, sir. A few seconds later, the servant handed Atta an unopened bottle of Hennessy. The minister passed it to me.
Disvirgin it. It's all yours.
A full bottle of cognac for me? I'm not really much of a drinker, sir.
Ha, you're the funniest journalist I've ever...
You're
the first journalist I've ever met who frets before alcohol. As for me, I really like my cognac, boasted the minister.
I can see. And I like cigars. I guess they go well with cognac, I said. Absolutely. And I love women. He paused. Beautiful women, of course. Uh-huh. The three vices. Or virtues, depending on who's speaking. His Excellency once said in this very house that with so many beautiful women in the world, he can't understand why any man would ever want to commit suicide. So let's end that there. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm going to read a short section from this one. And oh, wow, you guys were so good. Thank you again. So let me just, in the interest of brevity, because I actually strategically did not ask how long I had, you know, because I'm constitutionally incapable of brevity. So if you don't tell me when to stop, then I can constitutionally go on forever. So, oh, I intend to. So this is a section which is actually a kind of backstory in Foreign Gods, Inc. Foreign Gods, Inc. tells a story. It's set partly in New York and partly in Nigeria. In New York, it's set in a gallery called Foreign Gods, Inc., which buys and sells the statues of deities and sacred objects that are pushed, stolen from different parts of the world. So it tells a story of an African immigrant student from Nigeria specifically, who's gone to Amherst College and studied economics and has great high expectations that he will get a job in the corporate world. But he finds out that in order to apply for the jobs, he needs a ticket, okay? And the price of the ticket in America is what, for an immigrant, is what you call green card, see? And so to get that green card, he has to marry somebody, an arranged marriage, really, somebody who is not on the same social level, intellectual level as himself. So it becomes a very abusive, mutually savaging relationship, which is ended in divorce. My protagonist takes on gambling and takes an alcohol, you know, he becomes an alcoholic and so on because he has all kinds of pressures. His mother, who is widowed in Nigeria, you know, is demanding that he be a caretaker of hers, which is what all of us have to go through. Sometimes, mostly happily, if you can afford it, but sometimes unhappily because, you know, when I was living in Nigeria, guys, people actually thought that there was money on American streets and that if you didn't, you know, pull together $1 million the first day you arrived, it's because you were lazy and you didn't want to pick up enough money. So when I went back to Nigeria the first time, a cousin of mine called me and said, okay, I want $3,000. And she said, you know, I know you, if I ask you for real money, you'll start making excuses. So I'm asking for something that you can just, you know, put your hand in your pocket and give. The funny thing was I had gone home after buying my flight ticket. All the spending money I had was $500. And she thought I could just pull $3,000 and give to her. There are those expectations. When I was in Nigeria, the first thing our friends did once they arrived in America was they would go pose next to a car. these flashy long cars, you know, we didn't know that some of them were picked up for $200, right? We thought that because of the size, they cost a lot of money. So we said, wow, this guy just went to America, wrote the next week, and he's already got a car, okay? And so there must be American streets must be flush with money, you know? And so this guy comes here, he has pressures from his mother, had pressures once he was married from this woman who just wanted to buy, you know, it's just, the novel is, it's looks at the idea of just this obsessive consumerism, say, and so on, at so many different levels. But at the center of the drama is that this protagonist, having undergone all these pressures, ultimately after 13 years of being a cab driver, because he can't find, when he gets a green card and he starts applying for jobs in the corporate world, but he shows up, is invited for interviews because his degree looks excellent. But when he shows up and speaks, he has a particularly strong accent. So that becomes, again, a way that he becomes excluded. And so he has to make a living because America doesn't forgive you your bills, right? If you don't find your dream job, you still got to pay for the bills. So he has to drive cabs. 13 years later, he reads a magazine story about this gallery called Foreign Gods Incorporated, who buys and sells deities. And this guy decides to return to his community and steal what used to be the god of war for his people to sell it to the gallery. So a great deal of the novel follows him on this journey, this drama of going to this heist, to steal a deity. But the section I'm going to read to you is a prayer section that happened like 100 years before, where the first Christian missionary arrived in this village where the deity is located, with the agenda that he must defeat and, destroy this deity. So he begins to convert some of the people of the community. And some of them are impressed, not initially by the theology of the deity, but simply by the fact that a white man came with guns that shoot from two mouths at once, simultaneously, a double-barrel gun. They'd never seen this. So they say, wow. A man who has this kind of gun, his God must be superior to ours. So that's so force becomes, or power, again, is implicated as part of the reason, the first reason that people begin to convert to Christianity. And so I'm going to read you a section where some of the converts begin to ask uncomfortable questions of this missionary whose name is Walter Stanton. Excuse me. Overwhelmed by the missionary's armed ensemble, many in Otonki became believers. As one of the converts explained to his neighbor, the white man's guns outspeak the guns of Otonki. Who can argue that the white man's god isn't stronger than Ngene? Ngene is the name of the local deity that this guy has gone to steal. Still, Reverend Stanton was often grieved by the convert's heresies and ways. In turn, the converts were vexed by aspects of the new religion that sounded contentious, if not downright nonsensical. During one session, Reverend Stanton's interpreter told the converts that the founder of the white man's religion was a bearded man god born in Bethlehem by a virgin. The converts didn't find the idea of a born god hard to swallow. After all, the deities in Otonki were carved by sculptors and then infused by men and women powerful in Ogwu. But born by a virgin, one new convert whispered to another. Both men shrugged, bemused. The white man knows many things, the other whispered back, but he doesn't know how to tell a good lie. Sometimes the converts voiced their doubts. One day, the interpreter said that the new god's father lived up in the sky, far beyond the clouds, beyond the reach of eyes. He said this divine father was so huge his feet lolled all the way down from the sky to rest on the earth. He then claimed that the missionary's god was present everywhere. Our people too have chukwu, the great God who lives in the sky, one baffled convert said. Everywhere we see the signs of his work. The drifting clouds are smoke from his pipe. Rainfall is his sneeze. All great rivers were born from his spittle. Wherever he scuffed his feet, mountains arose. Valleys were formed wherever he stamped his feet. Chukwu is mighty, but we never say that he's everywhere. His home is in the sky, and he hardly leaves his hut to visit the earth. He comes down to peer around only when something big happens in the world. And when he comes, nobody waits to be told. The earth shakes with rain, the like of which is seen only once in ages. If your own God lives everywhere, then why haven't my two eyes seen him? The interpreter is playing the question to the chief missionary. It's because the true and living God is invisible, Reverend Stanton explained. For a moment, the curious convert was silent, but his face wore an incredulous expression. How can something be everywhere and yet invisible? He asked finally. He is creator and maker of everything. With him, everything is possible. He can do and undo, came Stanton's response. Then he should do to make himself visible, the convert insisted. Why not tell him to appear to us in his body? Then all our brothers and sisters will leave their ways and come follow him. We can't tell God what to do, Stanton explained. I'm not saying tell him. Take a sacrifice to him and beg him, said the convert. It is through sacrifice that gods are deceived. Our God cannot be deceived, Stanton explained with visible impatience. He knows everything, including the secrets of our hearts. You deceive your own so-called gods because they are not gods at all, only phantoms. True Christians accept God's wisdom. It's not given to us to behold God in body, only as spirit. Ngene too is a spirit, but he also has a body, insisted the convert. His spirit is buried in the river, but you can see his body at the shrine. Stanton scratched at his neck, leaving splashes of reddened skin. His words tumbled out fast. What you call Ngene is nothing. It's a lie with which you've imprisoned yourself. It doesn't live in the river, nor does it own the river. Our own God owns everything. He made you a river and also the wood Ngene was carved from. The convert's face showed confusion. All these years, our fathers and forefathers made sacrifices to Ngene. They gave it cocoyam and yam. They offered it chicken and goat. In fact, when their hands were strong with wealth, they brought cows to a shrine. When their wives had new babies or when their farms had increased, they went to the shrine to say Dalo to Ngene. We too learn to do like our fathers and forefathers. Mother goat chews yam peelings, her offspring watch her mouth and learn. As soon as we stop suckling our mother's breast, we were taught the secrets of the river. We learned that the river belongs to Ngene, that the God spirit lives in that river. Are you saying then that Ngene stole the river from your deity? If the river belonged to your God all along, why didn't he have sent a diviner to tell our forefathers and us about it? That's why we're here, Stanton explained. We came to tell you about the God who made all things. We brought you the good news of the one true, indivisible God. We're here to spread the word about he who alone sits on the mantle of glory. I still have one question that scratches my inside, the inquisitive convert said with a mischievous glint in his eye. Ask it, the missionary invited eagerly. Does your God owe money to another God? Perplexed, Stanton asked, what do you mean? I still don't understand why your God likes to be invisible. Around here, those who take to hiding are men who don't wish to pay their debts. An edge of exasperation nudged away Stanton's eager expression. Fixing the interpreter with a glare, he spoke in a slow, halting manner. Tell them to get it into their thick heads, once and for all, that there aren't other gods besides the one we worship. Tell them that our God can't owe anybody because he owns everything in heaven and on earth. Tell them that he's invisible because he's holy. Tell them that we're all tainted sinners, corrupted by the original sin of our first parents, Adam and Eve, who ate the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. Tell them that because all have sinned and come short, our eyes can see God in flesh and blood. Tell them that nobody who beholds God can live to tell about it. Tell them, finally, that there will be no more questions today. Thank you very much.